content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. Hello, this is Shadate Hargett Hill from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall be reading to you from Triangle Business Journal. Taking a look at the cover, it says the cover story is Game of Credits. Corporations and business executives continue to take hundreds of millions of dollars in tax credits, even when most statutes have expired or are about to expire. Also on the cover, credit. How the Tar Heel State Almost Lost the Expansion. Executive voice, leading thousands of Triangle workers. And the viewpoint, there's a way to cut healthcare costs. Healthcare providers are rewarded for the volume of treatments for care rather than for the value of care in preventing or minimizing disease. Current payment mythology raises cost. Those are the stories that are on the cover, as well as one called Feeding Off the Frenzy. Stephen Fritz knows the residential market is hot and he's ready to act. Let's start with the cover story. Changing tactics. Tax credits are succeeding in North Carolina, but some still get the benefit. While North Carolina lawmakers are grappling with whether to cut the state's corporate tax rate for a fifth year in a row, a near-record 9,800 individuals and corporations took advantage of several expiring and expired tax subsidy laws in 2016 to cut their bills even more. Led by legacy employers such as Duke Energy, IBM, and GlaxoSmithKline, and even business leaders like Strata, Sollers, Marcus Wilhelm, and Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst, North Carolina taxpayers combined to claim nearly $484 million in business-related tax credits and refunds in 2016. It was an 8% decrease in the total load from the year prior, when $524 million in corporate tax deductions were claimed, but still 14% higher than the state's five-year average. State budget estimators are also still unsure how many more millions of dollars in unclaimed tax credits rate may remain from future year tax filings. A recent report by the Pew Charitable Trust even criticized the state for having not adopted a plan for regular evaluation of tax incentives. It rated North Carolina as trailing other states for its dependency on one-time studies instead of creating a regular process for measuring results. Lawmakers need to recognize these major budget commitments and demand better evaluations, says Josh Goodman, co-author of the report, noting that leading states like Florida, Maryland, Minnesota, and Washington have in recent years created models for regular reviews from which lawmakers can make informed decisions. The credits are completely legal, even though many of the tax credit laws have been expired for 3 years or more. That's because of the carry-forward provision in nearly all of the states that allow a taxpayer who might not be able to use all the credit in 1 year to break it up into pieces. The carry-forward term for the state's research and development tax credits, for example, can be carried for up to 15 years. In the past 8 years, North Carolina has written off more than $2.7 billion in taxable profits from companies that qualify for credits, according to analysis by Triangle Business Journal, of the annual state mandated reports compiled by the State Department of Revenue. Most all of the tax credit categories are trending down as companies deplete their stash of credits earned prior to the statute's sunset years. IBM, for example, claimed an average $13 million a year in credits for research and development at its campus in Research Triangle Park between 2012 2012 and 2015. But the company's take-in for 2012 and 2015 was only $4.5 million. The research and development credit from which it and many other companies in the Triangle benefited expired January 1st, 2016. Wythe Holding Corp, acquired by Pfizer in 2009, had for many years ranked about the state's largest tax credit takers for its investments in jobs, research, machinery, and equipment at its vaccine production plant in Sanford. But in 2016, the company claimed only 3,200 in credits. The exemption in 2016 was the state's lucrative tax credits for renewable energy property that sunset January 1, 2016. Nearly 6,000 taxpayers trying to beat that deadline filed tax credit claims for investments made in solar farms and other renewable energy projects across the state for a total of $245 million in reduced tax, or about half of all the corporate tax credits tracked from the Department of Revenue reports. The largest beneficiaries of the renewable energy credits were the investment firms financing the projects, a list that includes some of the largest insurance and banking organizations in the region. Names such as Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, and North Carolina Farm Mutual Insurance. Wealthy business and philanthropic leaders from across the state were also major players in renewable energy projects. Chapel Hill Strata Solar Projects CEO Marcus Wilhelm claimed $4.8 million in tax credits in 2016, increasing his take over the last 4 years to $12.1 million. Several members of the Belk family in Charlotte, including Sarah Belk Gambrell, John R. Belk, and Thomas M. Belk, claimed close to $11 million in renewable energy tax credits in 2016. Any tax credit or incentive targeted at businesses should be able to pass the but-for test. In other words, would the desired activity occur without the public subsidy? Ask John Conorno, an economic policy expert and principal with South by North Strategies in Chapel Hill. If so, the subsidies arguably may be worthwhile. If not, then the number of other public needs. In that case, the money simply then is nothing more than a transfer from the public at large to an individual firm or group of firms. The changes highlight how North Carolina is in transition when it comes to providing economic incentives. What North Carolina lawmakers have instead been more focused on in the past 5 years is simply simplifying the state taxing code. The General Assembly has eliminated all but about a half dozen of its more than 300 corporate tax credit and refund provisions adopted in the last 20 years by letting those laws sunset without extension. It's funny, I don't hear anyone mention tax credits anymore, says Andrew Tate, an economic developer from Hendersonville, who is serving as the 2017 board president of the North Carolina Economic Developers Association. The NCEDA had for years supported the extension of the state's tax credit programs under the William S. Lee Act and Article 3J, a reference to the state statute that codified tax credits for job creation and business investments, but the lobbying association dropped that effort when political support began to grow for the corporate tax rate cuts. In place of the tax credits, which has benefited companies that some policymakers argued would be investing with or without the credits, lawmakers adopted a tax reform plan to reduce its overall corporate tax rate structure to create a more even playing field for both big and small businesses. North Carolina, prior to the 2013 tax return, had one of the highest corporate tax rates in the South at 6.9%. Under a step-down model that began in 2014, the rate was reduced to 3% in 2017. Now, a Senate bill weaving its way through the legislature cut $1 billion. in state tax collections over the next 2 years, including another proposed reduction to the state corporate tax rate from 3% to 2.5%. Corporate tax income contributed nearly $1.1 billion to the state's budget in fiscal year 2015-2016. But corporate tax receipts in 2017 are projected around $911.5 million, according to the North Carolina General Assembly Fiscal Research Division. The question that our clients want to know is whether the goal of reducing corporate income or other tax will tip the balance of the ability of a state to support healthy investment in future infrastructures, says James Blair, a site selection consultant and managing director at Atlanta-based Navigator Consulting. Blair points to Kansas, which in 2012 also made major cuts to its tax base and now faces a $346 million budget deficit as the poster child of failed policies. The continued reduction of the corporate income tax is terrific publicity for North Carolina, but so far, there does not appear to be any sign that the state is outperforming neighbors who have not reduced their rates. He says the underlying message that lawmakers argue for cutting the corporate tax rate is a similar message argued in the mid-1990s. When the state adopted its first set of business-targeted tax credits under the William S. Lee Quality Jobs and Expansion Act, Lee was a former CEO of Duke Power who died in 1996. The message is that companies will use the savings to add jobs and make more investments in the state. But because corporate tax returns are not public record, specific details for how many jobs were created or investments made are not categorically documented. The perception is that most of the tax credits targeting job creation and business property investments are making those investments in the state's wealthier urban areas like Raleigh, Durham, and Charlotte, even though a tier system was set up to help incentivize companies to locate the poorer parts of the state by offering more credits. Indeed, among the list of the largest claimants for credits in 2016 under the now expired Article 3J provisions are Charlotte-based Bank of America and Durham-based Cree. However, the list also includes the parent company of Lowe's Home Improvement based in Iredell County, Apple's Data Center in Chautauqua County, and Merck Sharp and Dome Corp, which have pharmaceutical plants in both Wilson and Durham counties. All of the credit-eligible investments made in those communities would have also predated the sunset of Article 3J at the end of 2013. The urban-rural disconnect. But the urban versus rural debate is now spilling over in North Carolina's other economic incentive programs, such as the Jobs Development Investment Grant, or JDIG, and One North Carolina Fund that provide discretionary funds to companies approved by the state's economic investment company and committees, or the governor, respectively. Companies qualifying for grants for either program have a contractual agreement with sets goals for both new investment and new jobs. If a company doesn't perform according to a contract, it is obligated to repay those funds per the state's clawback rules. JDIG has been under fire for favoring wealthier counties, and a Senate bill sponsored by Senate Appropriations Committee Chair Harry Brown of Jacksonville would set new limits and rules on the amount of JDIG funds that could go to companies expanding or relocating to the Triangle or Charlotte. Brown's proposal would instead redirect most of the JDIG funds to power lower-tier counties. North Carolina Secretary of Commerce Tony Copeland, following the announcement May 9th that global financial services firm Credit Suisse will be adding 1,200 new jobs at its campus in Research Triangle Park, says he is in full support of adding economic incentives that target the state's more economically challenged regions. But he doesn't think those funds should be redirected from JDIG away from Raleigh and Charlotte. Just look at this, he said, pointing to the crowd still gathered in front of the Credit Suisse RTP office building. As part of its deal with the state, Credit Suisse could receive up to $40.12 million from a JDIG grant over the next 12 years if it meets its job creation goals. Time will tell, Copeland says, but no one has shown me factual information that if we eliminate JDIG from populous counties, that it'll go under, that it'll go to other counties. I like to see the factual information to back that up. Absolutely, I would be an advocate for a more robust fund for more rural and less socioeconomic counties. Something different, more robust, but not take away from what's working. Tate says several NCEDA members he has spoken to from more disadvantaged Tier 1 and Tier 2 counties are skeptical of Brown's proposed changes to JDIG. The consensus seems to be that if that were approved and grants for Tier 3 counties such as Wake and Mecklenburg cap that, it was not good for North Carolina, Tate says. Continuing to cut us into little pieces and divide us is not the most effective way to attract economic opportunities. We have capacity to support distressed areas of the state with new and expanded tools without taking something away that we already have. This is Success Secrets. Muma McConnell gives tips for NC entrepreneurs. Between them, they have decades of leadership in the Triangle's growing entrepreneurship scene. Meet Mitch Muma and John McConnell, the latest inductees at the Council for Entrepreneurial Development's North Carolina Entrepreneur Hall of Fame. Muma is managing partner of the area's largest legacy venture capital firm, Durham's InterSouth Partners. Successful exits included portfolio firms such as SmartPath, acquired by DoubleClick in 2004, and Acipiter, acquired by CMGI in 1998. McConnell co-founded Medic Computer Systems in Raleigh, leading it through an initial public offering and what would be a record $922.8 million buyout. His A4 Health Systems was sold to Allscripts for $272 million, and he founded McConnell Golf, which owns 11 golf courses in the Carolinas and Tennessee. They offered their respective takes on the Triangle entrepreneurship scene in an exclusive Q&A. What's the biggest entrepreneurship hurdle in the Triangle right now, and what's the fix? Muma, the biggest hurdle to overcome for us is to continue to attract and retain talented, entrepreneurially minded leadership people come first. Then the capital will flow. McConnell, bigger companies are hiring the top technical talent and salaries are escalating. Whether you're an investor or an entrepreneur, we hear the term secret sauce a lot when it comes to success. In your success, what was the secret sauce? Muma, the secret sauce in our case is the management teams that run our companies, particularly the CEOs and founders who have the vision and ability to make good things happen. When our investors came to due diligence, they were very impressed by the quality of management teams in our portfolio, which helped us raise capital as well. McConnell, hiring the right staff members and giving them total responsibility and equity in the business and a long-term vision of where the business could go. What's a common mistake you see entrepreneurs making? Muma, understanding the time it will take to build a company of enduring value. As my partner, Dennis Daugherty, has said many times, venture capital and company building is a get-rich-slow scheme. McConnell, not understanding the sales process and investing in that part of the business. In lawsuit, Quintilis IMS sues ex-employee now at rival firm. Quintilis IMS has brought a breach of contract lawsuit against a former senior business development employee who left the company last month and reemerged at a competitor. The company named as Quintilis in the complaint alleges in its complaint that John Manaccio voluntarily resigned from his position as a senior business development director for Quintilis Commercial U.S. on April 12th, almost immediately departing for competitor Inventive Health, thus breaching contracts that included an employee confidentiality and non-solicitation agreement and a business development incentive plan. The complaint says Inventive is a primary competitor in an operating segment known as Integrated Engagement Services, and that Manaccio had been employed by Quintilis IMS and legacy companies for approximately 5 years, most recently as an employee of the operating segment in question. In fact, Mr. Manaccio literally was the face of Quintilis to its largest account in integrated engagement services. The company states in the complaint, adding at the time of his resignation, Mr. Manaccio served a major account with a Quintilis customer whose integrated engagement services business represented substantial annual revenue for Quintilis. Mr. Manaccio had access to trade secret, proprietary, and confidential business information about other important Quintilis accounts. The complaint alleges Manaccio was privy to, quote, negotiation histories, wins and losses in head-to-head competition with Inventive, end quote, among other issues. Quintilis IMS states that it received a letter from Inventive that stated it had ordered Manaccio employment at Vice President of Business Development in the company's contract sales organization, which he had accepted and would begin April 24th. A Quintilis IMS spokeswoman declined further comment. Daniel Lanclanti of Freeborn and Peters, who is representing Manaccio, also declined to comment May 9th. In law, Warden Smith woos Smith Anderson partner for crowdfunding team. Warden Smith has wooed career-long Smith Anderson Blunt, Dorset Mitchell & Jernigan's corporate and securities partner Benji Jones to its Raleigh office. Jones started at her new firm May 8th. While Jones's practice includes areas such as traditional securities, work and mergers and acquisitions, she's recently been focusing on crowdfunding and fintech financing, according to Warden Smith. Jones says Warden Smith's platform, particularly when it comes to serving small to mid-sized privately held businesses across the state, was attractive to her given areas where she recently has focused her practice. At her former firm, Jones led a team that advised Charlotte-based automotive technology startup ITFT on Securities and Exchange Commission matters, as the company recently became the first in the state to initiate a regulation crowdfunding campaign under the Title III of the Jobs Act. She also worked on the passage of the North Carolina Providing Access to Capital for Entrepreneurs and Small Business Act. and Pharma, Raleigh's INC Research buying Boston CRO for $4.6 billion. Raleigh's INC Research is the largest contract research organization to commit to mega merger. INC Research announced May 10th that it will merge with Boston-based CRO Inventive Health in an all-stock deal that values the latter at $4.6 billion, and the combined company at an enterprise value of $7.4 billion. INC Research CEO Alistair McDonald will serve as CEO of the combined company following completion of the deal, which is expected in the second half of this year. Along with the contract research capabilities, Inventive also provides contract commercial services, a global market that INC Research says is expected to be valued at $34 billion in the next 3 years. Earlier this year, INC Research announced a 500-job expansion based in the Triangle and a new corporate headquarters at Morrisfield Park, which it broke ground in April. Last year, the Triangle's Quintiles was acquired by IMS Health in a deal valued at roughly $9 billion. Continuing on in pharma, Chief Medical Officer resigns at Novan. Novan's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. M. Joyce Rico, has resigned. No reason for the resignation was disclosed in an SEC filing other than it was, quote, for good reason, as defined in the employment agreement dated August 25, 2015, between Dr. Rico and the company, end quote. The departure comes as the company recently announced the hiring of former Quintiles executive Paula Brown Stafford as its chief development officer. Novan is developing a number of nitric oxide-based therapies in the dermatology space, including its lead candidate SB204 for the treatment of acne. The company announced mixed phase 3 results earlier this year, but remains confident about the drug. IPO. G1 Therapeutics outlines plan for its public offering. After announcing plans to raise upward of $100 million in an initial public offering, Research Triangle Park-based G1 Therapeutics has priced its offering and disclosed how the proceeds will be used. In a SEC filing May 8th, G1 said it will sell 6.25 million shares of common stock at a price of between $15 and $17 per share. Proceeds of the IPO will be primarily used for the continued development of its cancer therapy candidates. The company stated offering the following breakdown: approximately $45 million to advance development of trilaciclib, approximately $20 million to advance development of G1T38, approximately $15 million for drug manufacturing and to advance development of G1T48, and the balance for working capital and general corporate purposes. Earlier this year, G1 announced it was enrolling patients in a phase 2 trial of Drylaciba for the treatment of triple negative breast cancer, as well as in a phase 1b/2a trial of G1T38 for the treatment of estrogen receptor positive breast cancer. In finance, Investor Heads to Coast launches new fund with a different model. As a triangle investment firm winds down, another is launching at the coast. Merritt Moore, managing partner of Raleigh's Lookout Capital, confirms he is heading a new company, Tidewater Equity Partners, and the Wilmington Institution is already deploying dollars. As Tidewater emerges, Lookout Capital is longer investing in new companies. With Lookout, our investors had signed up for 5-year commitments, he explains. We went through the initial 5 years and we did an extra year, kind of with the idea that we would figure out what to do, and to do what we continue doing, investments through Lookout, or does it make sense to do it through a different vehicle? Lookout will continue to invest in its existing portfolio. Moore notes, Moore says that through Lookout, he learned a lot, lessons he plans to leverage with the new fund. Half of Tidewater's backers came from Lookout, he says. Moore moved to Wilmington and is launching the new firm at the coast, but he plans to frequent the Triangle. The company, which has already raised more than $6 million, isn't operating under a traditional fund or a model. Instead, Tidewater will focus on a small company, direct investment, healthcare-related venture capital, and innovation consulting. Regulators and regulations. Small NC banks watch future of Dodd-Frank. North Carolina bank executives are eyeing Washington, where lawmakers have started the process of rewriting Dodd-Frank banking regulations. While much of the repeals wouldn't impact small banks directly, CEOs such as Bob Hatley of Raleigh's Paragon Commercial are watching carefully. Small banks are not a risk to the economy, he says. They're only a risk, frankly, to their shareholders, so they need to be treated that way. He points to cuts in authority to measure, the measure of which would give the Consumer Financial Protection Agency as a positive, calling the group a knee-jerk reaction to the financial crisis. Even though it's for banks over $10 billion, what they're doing at that level trickles down to everybody, and going after that group is going to make a profound amount of difference, Hartley predicts. On the upswing, 2 years after layoffs hit Morrisville-based e-commerce software firm Channel Advisor, the company is growing again. According to a securities filing released this month, the company increased its workforce 7% year over year, though it didn't disclose an updated headcount. At the end of 2016, it has 697 employees, with most located in the U.S. The company said the increase is intended to help drive revenue growth and support our overall operations. At the time of the 2015 layoffs, executives blamed pricing issues. The company began an aggressive pivot, putting the focus squarely on larger customers. And David Spitz, who moved into the CEO role when co-founder Scott Wingo stepped aside 2 years ago, says it's seeing results. It's a strategy the firm continued in the first quarter, terminating 37 customers with contracts less than $15,000. At the same time, it increased large customer accounts, ending the quarter with 147 accounts, customers whose contracts exceeded $100,000. Now let's take a look at a viewpoint. In Washington, it is possible to reduce health care costs. This is Dr. Ralph Snyderman, who is the Chancellor Emeritus at Duke University and a founder and former CEO of the Duke University Health System. Passage of the American Health Care Act by the House of Representatives is raising fears that tens of millions of Americans may lose their health care coverage. This makes it all the more essential to address the key reason that providing coverage is so difficult, the cost of health care. A major cause of soaring costs is that healthcare providers are reimbursed for volumes of procedures, fee for service, rather than for outcomes of care, value-based reimbursement. While rarely discussed, current payment methodology raises costs and actually prevents more effective care. The good news is that the problem can be fixed. In doing so, costs can be reduced, care can be more effective, and coverage can be easier to provide. Healthcare costs over $3.5 trillion per year, and it is driven by expensive treatment of chronic disease long after the underlying disease or condition has developed. Preventable chronic diseases account for almost 75% of healthcare expenses. Healthcare providers are rewarded for the volume of treatments for complex care rather than for the value of care in preventing or minimizing disease. Care for heart attacks provides a good example. Providers are amply reimbursed for individual components of high-cost interventions such as clot dissolvers, coronary artery stents, and coronary bypass surgery. These treatments are effective in treating the disease event, but successful outcomes require continuity of care, which receives far less funding and attention from providers. Even more important, risk for cardiovascular disease can be identified early and treated effectively to prevent heart attacks. Yet our healthcare system largely overlooks prevention due to inadequate reimbursement for such care. Not surprisingly, care delivery follows the money. The perverse financial incentives that prevent cost-effective care were clearly illustrated by a heart program initiated at Duke University while I was Chancellor for Health Affairs. A pilot program to minimize the severity of congestive heart failure focused on intense patient education, planning for prevention, and the provision of health coach to coordinate care. The results were astounding. Clinical outcomes were greatly improved and costs were reduced by almost 50%. While the overall cost savings were dramatic, the Duke Health System lost money because this program decreased the number of highly reimbursed hospitalizations and increased the number of poorly reimbursed clinic visits. Thus, the incentive of reimbursing for intense treatment of disease rather than prevention made this innovative, cost-effective program unsustainable. Type 2 diabetes is another debilitating and expensive chronic disease with tangible opportunities for prevention. The pre-diabetic stage of type 2 diabetes is common, easy to identify, and potentially reversible. 86 million Americans have pre-diabetes, and 90% do not even know that they have it. Knowledge of the condition followed by modest lifestyle change can dramatically decrease one's risk for developing type 2 diabetes. Yet, implementation of effective prevention or risk minimization strategies is stifled by low reimbursement that renders proactive approaches to care unaffordable for most healthcare providers. The U.S. healthcare enterprise is among the most creative in the world, and know-how and rapidly emerging technologies are making effective disease prevention a reality. To decrease the crushing cost of treating established disease, we need to prevent or diminish disease development. We can do this by changing healthcare reimbursement rewards, and we can change this also by going away from fee-for-service, which rewards attention to high-volume procedures. Rather, reimbursements should incentivize prevention and positive health outcomes, thus encouraging innovative and effective solutions. Value-based payments to reward good outcomes rather than volume of procedures is in the early stages of implementation. It is within the purview of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services and private insurers to expedite value-based reimbursement. This will unleash more effective approaches to prevent disease, provide more effective care, and decrease costs, thereby enabling effective legislation to expand across to care. It is incumbent on the leaders of health care reform and politicians to recognize the need to enhance the effectiveness of health care delivery and to create a reimbursement system to incentivize this. Now we move to people on the move. In architecture, engineering, and design, Megan Bowles, Christy Zeiler. LS3P named Megan Bowles an associate principal in the firm. Christy Zeiler was named a senior associate at LS3P. Charles Brown was named North Carolina Surveying and Mapping Geomatics Area Leader at DRMPI. In health, Eric Norris joined Mako Medical Laboratories as an executive team member. In technology, Michael Grayer, Kitware Inc. hired Michael Grayer as a technical leader. Ramesh Ratan, CEO of Bell & Howell, was named a non-postal vice chair on the Universal Postal Union Direct Mail Advisory Board. In real estate, Jennifer Jenkins, Nicole Condon, Jennifer Gregg. Better Homes and Gardens Go Realty hired Jennifer Jenkins, Nicole Coden, and Jennifer Gregg as sales associates in its Durham office. Also in real estate, Christine Lay was named a real estate agent at Coldwell Banker Advantage. Serena Harris was hired as a broker at Triangle Real Estate Group. Sydney Frazier was hired as a real estate specialist at Linda Craft and Team Realtors. In architecture, engineering, and design, Les Parker, Jay Sykes, Smith Senate Architecture named Les Parker an associate. Jay Sykes of Smith Senate recently passed the National Council of Architectural Records Board's test to receive his official license as an architect. Eileen McDonald, LS3P named Eileen an associate in the firm. In A&E, LS3P named Julie Bargott an associate in the firm. Turning to legal, Spiff, Denham, Naren, Drake, Sessing, and Myers LLP hired Andrea Bosquez Porter as a partner in his family law. Former president of the North Carolina Hospital Association, William Pulley, joined the Raleigh office of Nexon Pruitt as senior counsel. In more real estate, Coldwell Banker Howard Perry and Walston hired Don Pelton as a sales associate in its Garner office. Andrew Wheeler joined the agency Strickland Road office in Raleigh as a sales associate. And Donna Trulli joined CBHPW's Fuquay Varina office as a sales associate, and et cetera. Al Cadillion, Colleen Pleasant Klein, and Janice Tippett were named to Enterprising Women's Adversary Board. In Spotlight, Stephen Fritz, president of H.H. Hunt Homes. A veteran of the home building industry, Stephen Fritz landed in the Triangle in 2015 as head of the Raleigh division of H.H. Hunt Homes. Now he has bottom line responsibility for all of the home builder's operations as its president. In his new post, Fritz is charged with achieving the strategic and annual operating plans for the H.H. Hunt Homes divisions in Raleigh and the Virginia markets of Richmond and Hampton Roads, as well as the central support functions of architecture, land, purchasing finance, and its design centers. Founded in 1966, H.H. Hunt is the parent company of H.H. Hunt Homes. Fritz, who is also a senior vice president at H.H. Hunt, is based in Raleigh, where the company employs a total of 230 people. About 30 of those local employees are in its home building division. The company built 106 homes in the Triangle in calendar year 2016. In such communities as Willoughby, Tyler Park, Adams Point, and Sterling Crest. What's one thing you wish people knew about your job? Fritz says, home building is such a noble profession. You are building perhaps the single largest investment a person will make, and they will raise their family there. What are some of your major goals for your position? Fritz says, to provide vision and leadership to maintain our exceptional reputation and success while expanding our geography and footprint in existing markets. Raleigh, in particular, plans to increase our home closed from 2016 to 2017 by over 50%. Biggest worry? Fritz says, the influence of micro events and employment growth on the home building industry, more importantly on the top Raleigh, Richmond, and Hampton Roads markets. Biggest pet peeve, Fritz says, not being able to resolve the tyranny of the urgent and the genius of the and with every solution. Education. Fritz has a bachelor's degree in civil engineering from the University of Maryland. His family, his wife Tammy, daughters Mackenzie, Taylor, Catherine, and Madison. The last book you read, Fritz says, Whiplash by Joy Ito and Jeff Howe. Taking a look in biz, fresh start. Raleigh woman builds her business one cake at a time. Tanya Davis of Raleigh is starting her business from scratch, literally. Davis laid off after 20 years in the corporate world and realized she had enough money saved up to start her own business. She loves to bake, and friends and family were always asking her to make them cakes. So this year, she is turning her passion into a business with Heavenly Cakes by Tanya. Wedding cakes, cupcakes, you name it, and she can bake it. She sold 50 cakes last month and is aiming for about $5,000 per month in sales. A standard chocolate cake costs $40. She thinks she can hit that plateau in 8 months. All of my cakes are homemade from scratch, she says. I love to dress them up and make them look pretty. Not done yet. Credit Suisse leader plans to stay through expansion. Credit Suisse Raleigh site lead Jim Campton was on vacation with his wife in Florida when he got a call from his boss in New York that he was urgently needed back in Research Triangle Park. Credit Suisse would be making the announcement May 9th that it is expanding and adding 1,200 new high-paying jobs in RTP with a ceremony arranged with Governor Roy Cooper. We just closed on a house in Florida, and my wife was really happy that I left in the middle of all that to come up here, Captain quips. But don't take this as a sign that Captain, who's 61, is getting ready to retire. That will come down to the line, he says, but we have a lot of work to do ahead. But we have a lot of work to do ahead of us. No short-term plans at this point. I'm having too much fun now. This is going to be way too exciting. Back in time. It's almost time. North Hills takes a look back 50 years. If you grew up in Raleigh, you remember standing in line for tickets at Cardinal Theater in North Hills and looking down at the time capsule and bemused by how it was decades until it would be opened. Well, that day is almost here. The little corner of Raleigh has changed and reflected a city around it. The Cardinal Theater site later became a Blockbuster Video. How ironic is that? After Blockbuster disappeared, it became a Bonefish Grill. But the time capsule has stood frozen in, well, time. Until now, on June 8th, the time capsule will be open at 10 a.m. We look forward to taking a step back in time to discover the history of North Carolina and North Hills and the city of Raleigh. It should be a fun surprise. Diane Smith of Raleigh was 8 years old when she watched the time capsule being installed. She remembers a small crowd on a sunny day, and while she can't recall the specific items, she says, I remember thinking, why is that item so special? or people would think that's dumb when it's open. Smith says her mother, who died in 2015, told her, "I'll be 90 years old when that thing is open. God willing, you'll probably have to push me in here to see it in a wheelchair." She also remembers the capsule was laid when the first movie ever was showing at the Cardinal, Caprice with Doris Day. In faster news, Rex Open returns with a new twist. Should golfers on the PGA Tour be allowed to use rangefinders? It's an issue the professional tours are weighing, and the PGA is using the web.com tour as a place to experiment with ideas such as that. So when the web.com tour returns to Raleigh for the Rex Hospital Open June 1st through 4th, the golfers will have full access to range findings. Web.com tour president Dan Glodd says it is part of his tour effort to try to innovate different ideas and see if it makes sense for the higher level. In particular, he says his tour will allow range finders to see his tour. He says his tour will allow range finders to see if that speeds up the pace of play and makes the athletes more relatable to fans. Those are the types of things we are going to embrace and test, Glodd says. While a web.com tour event has nowhere near the impact of a PGA event like the one just held in Wilmington, the competition at TPC Wakefield Plantation will have some serious cash. The winner gets $117,000 out of a total purse of $650,000. This is the 30th anniversary of the event, which raises money for the Rex Healthcare Foundation. Tournament director Brian Crusoe says the tournament hopes to raise $400,000 this year after raising $380,000 last year. Moving on to headliners, big names speak at commencement. There's a stellar group of speakers lined up for a big Mother's Day weekend of graduation day commencement events. On May 13th, NC Central University gets an early start at 8 a.m. with Joan Higgins Botham, a retired astronaut, and Mike Morgan, Associate Justice of the North Carolina Supreme Court, speaking to the crowd at O'Kelly Reddick Stadium. At 9 a.m., Raleigh Mayor Nancy McFarlane addresses the NC State University crowd at PNC Arena. At 10 a.m., radio host Tom Joyner speaks to Shaw University at the Raleigh Convention Center. And then at 7 p.m., Becky Jacobs, Chief Engagement Officer at Simple Change Wellness, addresses the Meredith College graduates. Then on May 14th, UNC Chapel Hill and Duke University will hold commencement exercises in their football stadiums. CNN anchor Brooke Baldwin will address her alma mater in Chapel Hill at 9 a.m., and David Rubenstein, a financier and philanthropist, will speak to Duke students at 9:30 a.m. In ratings, CEOs love North Carolina, but they love Texas more. Chief executive officers around the country are high on North Carolina, according to a new survey from Chief Executive Magazine. The magazine surveyed more than 500 CEOs, and the Tar Heel State ranked number 3 overall when it came to best states for business. Texas was number 1 for the 13th year in a row, and Florida was number 2 in the 5th straight year. California was number 50 for the 5th straight year, with New York at number 49. In specific categories, North Carolina ranked number 6 for workforce quality and number 7 for living environment. It also ranked number 3 for tech and number 4 for manufacturing. And now it's time for the editor's notebook. Sergata Morkihi is editor of Triangle Business Journal. He writes, CEOs stress the power of engaged workers. In the past 3 weeks, my colleagues David Tran, his assistant Chris Hugo, and I have spent countless hours together visiting the offices of the winners of the 2017 Triangle Business Journal CEO of the Year Awards. Tran and Hugo are accomplished videographers, and we wanted to chronicle the journeys of these successful people who have benefited the community over the years through jobs, capital investment, and nonprofit work. Among many other things, after spending about an hour with each executive, it is remarkable how similar these individuals are, regardless of their upbringing, industry, and academic credentials. Many have said before, and I can attest unequivocally to this, that successful and apt leaders are committed to the well-being of their workers. Almost all of them talked in length about how individuals within their companies and organizations shaped the success of the enterprise. They talked about the power of we rather than I, and they talked about being lucky in critical times. Winner Bob Luddy remembered the time he was not going to make payroll some two decades ago, but a check for $27,000 arrived in the mail the Friday before the Monday payroll. Otherwise, that may have been the end of Captive Air, he recalls. Today, Captive Air sells more than $400 million in product and service annually. PPD founder and serial entrepreneur Fred Eichelman recalled from his Wilmington offices how he trusted his lieutenants to march on to build the giant CRO and often went against the grain of traditional thinking. You need to develop trust among the people you work with, Eichelman told other people off camera. Nothing can be done alone. The stories of these CEOs will be shared at our upcoming event on May 19th, and the videos likely will capture only a part of the lesson that every business person needs to hear. Sure, we have a growing problem of pay inequality when it comes to the CEO and workers in the company, but great leaders face and discuss circumstances with the workers directly and extract the emotional connection to a company's success and its failures. I don't know how these CEOs and leaders will perform in the future, but I do know one thing. Their circle of trust grows every year. They are getting the buy-in from more and more of their workers by bringing them inside the circle. As many of them said during our visit, sometimes we complicate things too much, and the solution to our problem is right in front of our eyes. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Shadate Hargett Hill, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a blind and print impaired audience. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Again, the number is 919-832-5138. See you next time on the radio.